This is AJ Ashworth reading Maybe the Birds, the title story from the new collection called Maybe the Birds. I watch the dog. The dog watches something through the patio doors to the backyard. Every now and then his head tilts to one side, in the way it does when I talk to him or sing to him. Although there is no sound that would make him do that now. Not that I can make out anyway. But dogs have better hearing, don't they? They hear things no human ear is capable of detecting. Like dog whistles, the low growl of thunder from 5 miles away, a million voices screaming from the other side of the world. Maybe the birds are singing, but I just can't hear them. Maybe there is someone out there shuffling about. Maybe, maybe. But this is all just wishful thinking. The birds, someone being out there. It's the way your mind gets in the quiet. He's probably just got his eyes on all the brown leaves in the yard and wondering why they're there. Why all these brown leaves in the spring, Ma? I imagine him asking in the human voice I have given to him. But I haven't got any answers. None that he would understand anyway. And so I keep quiet and just carry on watching as he tilts his head the other way. Not once looking at me. Eyes full on whatever has got his attention through the grey dust coating the glass on the patio door. The little dots of his pupils as black as the night used to be. Every day, I tell the dog I will leave him the birds. It's what I do. It's part of our routine now. I get up, get dressed, then stand in front of him as he stares up at me from the settee, where he and I have been trying to sleep all night, and say, "Well, Sleepy Harry, whatever happens, I'm going to leave you the birds, okay? If nothing else, you'll get those at least." And he tilts his head first one way and then another, before jumping down off the settee and sitting at my feet. Not sure what it is I am telling him, but hoping, no doubt, it is to do with food, or perhaps the river, where Richard used to take him sometimes, or a long walk over the moors on those frosty mornings when his breath would puff out like little ghosts, as he ran on ahead of us, searching for rabbits, for rats. I don't like to go so far with him now, though. You never know what might be out there. So I just take him while the sun is still low and murky, then around the fields of dust that used to be yellow with rapeseed at the back of the house, watching while he sniffs at the shriveled scrubs of green there, not sure whether he should pee on them or not, if it's all right to do his business on such open ground. But nobody ever comes out of the farmhouse like they used to, and so I just give him the nod, tell him, "Go on, boy, it's okay," him looking up at me before lifting a leg or cowering down, the green plants trembling as he wets them, small clouds of grey puffing up from the blighted dry of the land. The dog is not called Harry, despite all the times I refer to him as Sleepy Harry or Barking Harry or, yes, even Dirty Harry. His name is Bear. It's the name Richard gave him because of how he looked when we first went to pick him up from Cumbria. Hair brown and fluffed, so it made his face round as a bear's. Body fat as a belly filled with fish. He was the only brown pup in the litter, the only one with a longer snout and those brown human eyes. All the other pups were black, same as the mother, more square-faced and short-snouted like the breed is supposed to be. But Bear was different, the odd one out. He was the only one that wasn't spoken for when we got there, but we'd have taken him anyway. And Bear seemed to sense that. He just sat and watched us as the woman talked to us, the other pups pawing and jumping, eager to get our attention. But that little brown misfit was the one for us, he knew it, and those eyes of his told us we were right. "I think he's a throwback," the woman said. "Probably some funny business somewhere way back, perhaps with an Irish terrier, a Lakeland." Richard picked him up, held him, put his nose down to Bear's mouth until the pink tongue came out and licked at the skin. "Doesn't matter to us." "He's pure though," she said. "It's just one of those things. He might look a bit." "Doesn't matter to us," Richard said again, scrunching at Bear's ear. The dog stopped licking him before pushing his head back to sniff at something in the air, something neither of us could smell. The woman scratched the top of her arm, the small bloom of pink there, the first I'd seen on anyone. "He's a strange one," she said, scratching harder. "Those eyes, it's like he can see through you. Makes you feel..." She shivered. "Maybe you've got something to hide," I asked with a smile. She glanced at her arm, pulled at the sleeve of her top. "No," she said, serious, "I haven't. What you see is what you get with me." Me and Richard glanced at each other, trying not to smirk. She went through to her kitchen then, came back a few minutes later, sleeve all the way back down, a pinprick of blood just visible at the edge of one cuff. "Aye, what you see is what you get. Don't hide anything, me. What you see." Her eyes were not yet glazed as they would have been just a few weeks later, as Richard's own eyes had become not long after the pink first showed itself to him. But we didn't know about any of that then. It was just the very start of things. But we would come to know it before long, when the reports started to come in. First from some small country on the other side of the world that neither of us had heard of. Then from other places too, ones we had. Gradually getting nearer, closer and closer to our own little home. Burr doesn't always follow me into my workshop when we get back from his walk. He often just gets on his bed and curls up with his fluffy dog, pushing his long snout into the near bald of its belly, his eyes closing to sleep. He knows our routine now, that I will go in there for a few hours and work at the clay on my bench, making it into small shapes he hasn't seen before, and that when I have a few of them, I will leave them to dry for a while before getting the ones from the day before to take to the kiln, placing them on the shelf, ready to fire, feeding the kiln with wood to get the temperature up, then keeping it going until day turns to night and the clay starts to set and harden to ceramic. It might seem gruesome, but what I make looks like rows of torsos when you line them up. Torsos with thighs, no heads, no arms, no calves, no feet, just the middles of bodies with all the interesting bits gone. Another way to see them though, a better way perhaps, is as a wide pipe that separates into two smaller ones lower down, which of course is what they are, but it's hard not to see the bodiness of them, the way they sit humanly in the kiln while the fire licks up around them. The ashes from the wood clinging to the clay, marking each one in a different way, until they are small, pale artworks, only pieces of art that nobody but us is likely to see. Bear doesn't know it, but these shapes are the way I will keep my promise to him about the birds. He has always loved watching them, listening to them in the time since we got him. So, making my own version of these syrinxes, these bird voice boxes, is how I will keep them alive for him now. That is why I go into my workshop every day and work at them with my fingers, with the fettling knives and loop tools, the wooden moulders and scrapers to bring the sound of the birds back for us, but ultimately for him, to make the air around the house vibrate with some kind of song once more after too many weeks of all this silence. I go to my workshop and check over all the fired and finished syrinxes, tilt some of them to see if there are any cracks or chips in the ceramic, stroke my finger over what should be bony cartilage, those vibrating rings and half rings that hula hoop their song into life. When I first thought about doing this a couple of weeks ago, after the skies grew quieter, but before the electricity stopped coming through, I searched for photos and articles online about how to make them, marvelling as I wandered from one page to another at how remarkable the syrinx is, a lower larynx in the chest, different to ours, and which could only be found in birds, an organ which enabled some to sing with two voices at the same time, with air from one lung making one song, air from the other a second. The internet told me the syrinx was an evolutionary wonder, that more research was needed to find out how it had come to be, that there was no evidence of it anywhere else, in non-avian dinosaurs or crocodiles, the bird's closest living relative. But that research won't happen now. The origins of that larynx will never now be found. It is not the only setback, of course. There are so many other things we'll never know. The age of discovery at an end, after all this time, after so many millennia of breakthroughs and progress, so many brains searching for answers. These syrinxes are not the pots and vases and kitchenware I am used to making. They're new, more of a challenge, something my hands didn't immediately know how to begin when I first picked up the clay, because there was no muscle memory for them, no felt familiarity. But I wanted to do it if I could, for me, for Burr. And making them was a way to fill these long, slow hours, to make the day turn to night, turn to day again, to keep on, stop my brain from dwelling on what has happened, what might still be happening, to give my fingers something other to do than scratch. I stand back and look over the syrinxes. There are about 100 of them now. I pick one up and blow into it. It does not, of course, sound completely like birdsong, because of the lack of membrane and muscle, the absence of a brain orchestrating things. It is less clear, less acrobatic, more whispery, like the memory of that which no longer exists and cannot now be recalled. But it is something. It gives the impression of song, at least, of what was. Like those paintings by Monet with their hints of water lilies and ponds, the poppies at Argenteuil, those ladies whose faces are shadowed by cloud or umbrella. These syrinxes can never be the same as what existed before. They are just my impression of them, my attempt to try and keep some of what was here alive, for us, for whomever or whatever might come across them in whatever future world there might be. I scratch at my arm now, at the welts and weals that have risen like swirls of pink dough over the last few days. There are more of them now, on my arms, the tops of my legs, so that almost all the pale skin that was there is gone, replaced by flame. I go and check my eyes in the bathroom mirror, as I do every few hours, pull the skin down under them, put my nose to the silver to get as close as I can, searching for any evidence of the glassiness that will no doubt come. But there is nothing except the wide white of my eyes, the brown irises, the full stops of pupils. I let my held breath go and grip the edge of the sink, stir down into the plug hole. Not yet, I say, please not yet. There is a blackness there beyond which light doesn't reach, but I try not to imagine myself falling down into it, focusing instead on the silver ring around it, the glint of light from the window. I think of Burr and what I need to do for him. I reach for a towel and lift it to cover the mirror. I will do what I have to, keep making, keep on, and something else. I will never look into my eyes again. Come on, boy, I say. Shall we go out? He lifts up from the toy dog, head to one side. He doesn't stand at first, but before I have chance to speak again, he is up and out of his bed, then in the yard, head turned towards me as he waits for me to follow. Hold on, I say, and go to my workshop. Pick up two of the syrinxes, one in each hand so as to avoid breaking them. So thin they are almost eggshell. I get some string too and scissors, place them in the bib of my dungarees, then go out to Burr. Stand there and watch him, the waves in his too long hair now, the stub of his tail fat and bushy. His head is still turned back, his eyes never leave mine. Come on, they say to me, don't hang around, there is running to be done, sniffing, finding. And he is right, there are things we need to do that I need to do. There are things that have yet to be achieved. I lift one of the syrinxes up and blow into one side, harder, then softer. Blow into the other side. A breathy tune that is the ghost of part of a blackbird's song floats up into the air. My chest flutters with recognition. Burr's head tips and I blow again. He tilts it the other way and wags his tail a little. I know this song, his face tells me. Play it to me again. His eyes, the way his head moves, brings water to my eyes, a hardness to my throat. It is the same way he often looked when Richard would pick up one of his harmonicas in the quiet of our evenings, softly blowing into it. Something slow and mournful. Sad Hours, or Weeping Willow Blues, or my favourite, Moon River. His long fingers would curve around the front of the instrument, index finger tapping the beat out on top. He would have his eyes closed and there would be deep lines between his eyebrows as he concentrated, his long lashes grazing the tops of his cheeks. Burr would watch and listen for a time, before moving closer to the wood burner, then lying down with his legs splayed out at the back, head on his paws as the wood hissed and crackled behind the blackened glass. Richard's gentle playing would make his eyelids lower and then finally close. his paws jumping after a time as he ran in dreams, an occasional half bark loud enough to wake him. To think we took evenings like that for granted, believing we would always have them. If only we had known, if only there'd been some kind of warning. But then what would we have done? How could we have made those times any more precious than they already were? "Let's go," I say to Burr now. He walks up to the gate, looks up as he waits for me to open it, jumping for my hand in the way he does sometimes when he's excited, eager to run or chase. In a few days' time, I will no longer lock the gate, but will instead leave it open, same as with the patio door. Doing these things to make sure he can run free. There will be other preparations too, like opening all the tins and packets of food and placing them where Burr can get to them, turning the tap on in the backyard so that he will have water for as long as it continues to flow. There will be other things too, squeaky toys hidden for him to find, mine and Richard's clothes taken out of wardrobes and drawers and left around the house, the yard. All of this in the hope he will be okay and that the pink will stay away from his own skin, that he will be one of the lucky ones, if you can call it lucky to survive. This is what I hope, at least, what I think of in the long nights. Otherwise, what was the point of anything? We go off into the field, to the edges where the trees are, the black leafless branches like burned bronchioles against the dusty sky. Burr wanders off, sniffs at the ground, at the withered grasses, as I place everything down next to one of them, one with branches low enough to reach that I do not need a stepladder for. I cut a long piece of string and thread it through a hole in one of the syrinxes, tie it around the branch, hoping as I do that any wind that comes will make the syrinxes sing without smashing them against the bark. I swing it around and it goes full circle, not once touching the tree. "Thank you," I say, eyes skyward, speaking to what I don't know. "Same again for all the rest, please." I lift the strung syrinx up to my lips, blow once more. Burr stops sniffing and looks over me, before carrying on. I do the same with the other syrinx, tying it to a different branch, blowing it in the same way until a fragment of nightingale wings through the air. Burr runs to me, then runs away again, mouth open and panting at this unexpected arrival of sounds he has not heard in weeks. I imagine him thanking me for giving him back the birds, or a version of them at least, his small dog heart bursting with happiness that there will be more than just weather and the sound of his own breathing in the days and weeks to come. I pick up the scissors and string, place them in my bib and walk Burr around the edge of the field before coming back home again. Burr stands next to his bed but does not get on it. His eyes follow me. He knows I am not finished yet. I go into my workshop and find a large tray, place more of the syrinxes on it, take them back out to the trees nearest to home, blowing into each one before stringing them up on the low branches, one of them the honk of a Canada goose, the other the hoo-hoo-hoo of a wood pigeon, another the scrike of a black-headed gull. I go back and get more, Burr at my heels all the while, me hanging them from the branches of other trees as he runs away, runs back again. "Silly Harry," I say, before checking the sound of them, the possibility of them hitting the bark should strong winds come. Every time they make a sound, every time they swing without striking wood, there are some blessings left at least, some things that can still lift the heart. I hang the last one, the conduit for the song of a robin, and then we go back to the house, finished for today. Standing at the gate before going inside, the two of us looking out at the grey fields, the jet-coloured trees, some of which are now strung with the syrinxes, dark Christmas trees dotted with strange baubles. Richard's voice is in my head suddenly, the soft sound of it whilst reading to me, as he often would in bed, this time part of Ray Bradbury's story, The Pedestrian, about a strange futuristic world where a man is arrested just for going for a walk, where the streets are empty of people, the world void of humanity and warmth. The line that had come to me was my favourite in the whole story. It was the one I waited for, anticipated, if Richard ever decided to read it. The image of a Christmas tree, tall and green and lit up in strings of colour and baubles. My throat tightens as his voice fades and is replaced by the sound of Burr's paws pounding over the land. "Come on then," I say to Burr now, and lock the gate, shutting the door as we get inside. Burr going to his bed, me going to hunt for what I can cook on the camping stove Richard got for us, along with numerous bottles of gas, hundreds of cans and packets of food, peas, soup, pasta, tinned peaches that we never would have bought before, but which we soon saw as a luxury when everything changed. Tomorrow I will take more sphinxes out, hang them from the branches of some of the other trees, taking my stepladder when there are no more I can reach without climbing, clambering up to loop them around the branches, making the trees into something more than just the dead things they are, with branches that might no longer run with life, but which will bloom with birdsong when the wind blows the right way. I open a tin of spaghetti bolognese, pour it into the pan, light the camping stove and then place the pan on top. Burr at the doorway to the kitchen as he picks up on the smell of pasta, the sweet tang of tomato sizzling, those small lumps of soya protein and beef hissing from the heat. After we've eaten, as the night comes, we will get on the settee and I will pick up one of Richard's harmonicas, touching my lips to the same place his touched, then blowing soft as I can for a few minutes until Bear lowers his head to the blanket. Him knowing these sounds are not the songs from before, not even songs at all, but trying to please me by behaving as if they are. Then I will lower the harmonica to the floor and we will lie there in the grey night, my eyes open as I listen for the wind, waiting for what sounds may come, for sleep. Maybe the birds will sing to us in their new and ghostly way, a strange but welcome kind of lullaby. Bear will raise his head as he hears them, eyes focused on the patio doors, wondering why there are sounds like that in the night when nothing should be singing at all.